Says Blood, the official True Blood podcast. I'm Kristen Bauer.
And I'm Deborah Ann Wohl.
And you've been invited in.
I want to do bad things with you.
Welcome back to Truest Blood, where we sink our fangs into the series episode by episode.
This week, we will delve into I Will Rise Up. It's written by Nancy Oliver and directed by Scott Winant.
Two geniuses.
Yes.
And, you know, relationships get really complicated in this episode of 209.
Yay.
Some bonds are healed. Some are broken. And others are just lost forever. So we're going to look at many examples, a few examples, and then we're just going to let you in on what it truly takes to be a background performer on a show like True Blood that relies on background performers.
Yes. And then we are thrilled to share with you all our conversation with Alan Hyde. His portrayal of Godric is riveting, and it is even more impressive when you find out how old he was at the time.
Yeah.
So most of his work you might not be familiar with because it's centered in Denmark, but we were lucky enough to be graced with his prolific talent for a short but very memorable run.
I know. I cry every time. Every time. It reaches a very tearful climax this week on True Blood.
Luke's vampire-killing vest explodes, decimating Godric's home. While Bill goes after the other soldiers of the Sun, trying to escape, Eric selflessly shields Sookie from the blast. Riddled with silver, he asks her to suck it out so he can heal himself.
Eric, I can't. It's too gross, and it's... you.
But feeling she has no alternative, she does as asked, until Eric reveals it was all a ruse to form the blood bond with her he so richly desires. Furious, she and Bill vow their undying hate for him, despite the erotic dreams of Eric that now haunt Sookie's V-laced mind.
In Bon Tom, Tara and Eggs are all beat up and don't know why. Marianne thinks it's a small price to pay for bliss and shrugs it off. But luckily, Lafayette does not. He and Letty Mae show up at Sookie's house and manage to drag an enchanted Tara, kicking and screaming, away from the ominous hold of Marianne.
I don't know what you is, but I'm feeling you, and you's a soulless bitch.
Meanwhile, Hoyt has a hard talk with his mama and sets an ultimatum. Maxine better get on board with Jessica or lose him forever. They try dinner at Merlot's, but things go south fast. And Hoyt and Jess storm out, leaving Maxine easy prey to Marianne's bewitching power.
Speaking of Marianne, with all her party animals locked up in jail, along with her prize, Sam Merlot, she makes a visit to the sheriff's office. She releases the others, only to discover that Sam has shifted his way out of his cell. Furious, she sets her minions on the trail.
The god who comes demands his sacrifice. Where is Sam Merlot?
But Sam is holed up with Andy, safe for now. Back in Dallas, Nan Flanagan, American Vampire League spokesperson of the year, is laying down the hurt on Godric and the others. She will have to clean up their mess, and someone will have to pay.
To Eric's dismay, Godric volunteers. In despair over the violence and hate that vampires and humans feel for each other, Godric chooses to meet the Sun and pay for his wrongdoing. Distraught, Eric pleads with him, to no avail.
Vater, Bruder, Sohn. Let me go.
Sookie, feeling a debt of gratitude to Godric and perhaps a tad touched by Eric's vulnerability, offers to stay with him as dawn breaks. She and Godric speak of life and death and God until the sun rises, and after 2,000 years, takes Godric from this world.
Mm-hmm. So this is an interesting episode. It's not really a joke a minute. You know, it's a little bit more somber. We're spending some more time, I feel like, with people and learning more about these characters. You know, we said in the intro, relationships here seem to be shifting. So my highlights for this episode really had to do with family relationships. Yeah. And the first one I want to talk about, I think, is Sookie and Jason, because I love this scene between the two of them.
I love this scene.
They're both so good. It's a side of them that we don't always get to see because, you know, especially for Sookie, it's really hard to be the lead of a show, especially like this one, because you're constantly moving plot forward and you don't get as many opportunities to just have a two-person relationship kind of chat. Right. So Anne is so lovely in it and real and connected, and as is Ryan. And, we needed this. They, you know, ever since Gran's funeral, they've been a bit disconnected. And so to have them come together in this scene, it reminds us why we care about all the plotty stuff.
Yeah. And it gives me a minute to not take Anna Paquin's performances for granted, because she's so such a powerhouse and such an actor athlete, where she goes from crying to being brave to being vulnerable kind of every 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And we're just used to her being there and so diligent and so flexible and powerful. And so this scene, it's just like, it is like a pause for a minute where it's like, wow, just look at these two people, these two talented, incredible people.
It's really well done. And I think also for Jason as a character, you know, it's nice to see him sitting with a woman who, you know, can't be a love interest, you know, that brings out another side of him, which is fascinating. Because, you know, we in a way, we think of Jason's issues as being issues with women, but really they're father figure issues, right? I mean, it's Eddie and Steve. That's his kryptonite. So anyways, you know, he's searching for that bond, and they have this lovely interaction that I'd like to highlight now.
Our whole family's gone, Sook. Everybody who counts. We're all alone. We're all that's left.
So you know what we gotta do? We gotta grow up. We gotta stick together. And we gotta be good to each other, or we're letting them down.
We gotta grow
wisdom
up.
The wisdom of Sookie Stackhouse. Yeah.
And Deb, you made a really good point in the outline that you wrote, and you talk about, you know, hooray to the writers. Because the rule is it either has to move the plot forward or be damn entertaining. And this isn't either.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly not entertaining in the sort of cliche sense. It's entertaining because of how well it's written and performed, but it's not a big flashy scene.
Right.
So the other family dynamic that I think is interesting and is shifting as well is Hoyt and his mother. You know, we're going to get into some really interesting stuff with Jim and Dale. Now, Dale, I'm so excited because, we'll get into her incredible talent coming up in the next couple of episodes. But the two of them are, like Ryan and Anna, powerhouse performers. And they really sell this relationship. And it's interesting because I look at Hoyt and Jessica, you know, they're these really wounded kids who are just looking for support and acceptance and can't really get it from anyone other than each other.
right.
But it's a really powerful moment to see Hoyt start to stand up to her.
You're my one son.
No, I'm not yours, Mama. I'm mine.
You're my baby boy.
I'm not a baby. I'm a grown-ass man.
That scene is so great.
It's so good. It's funny and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And it's uncomfortable.
Yeah. The way that he says, you're full of hate and I see you now.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so healing. And it really, that is him growing up.
Yeah. Yeah. What, and then what's really wonderful in the way that it's written is that then we, you know, we try to do this dinner. So Hoyt's made this stand. He's trying to grow up and show that he is. And we try to take this step forward. And Maxine and Jessica aren't capable of it because of their own wounds, right? So Maxine's got her own wounds and Hoyt's all she's got. So she lashes out. And I think Jess just sees her dad sitting across from her. That's who she sees. And she sees her father in the way that he treated her, but now treating someone that she maybe loves more than herself. And so, you know, what do? Right. Hoyt now needs to be saved and she's a predator.
Right.
So it's a very dangerous situation.
Yeah. And that, to your point on belonging, where she says, I was made a vampire against my will. I don't have people. I don't have family except your son.
Yeah.
Right. That's now her chosen family.
And Bill is not super chosen. I think that is why that relationship is so interesting to me. That grows. But yeah, you know, the closest person that she's found that is her choice so far in this new life is him. So she's, you know, he is her only tether, really.
Yeah. I mean, really, really, this episode is interesting. It's deep.
Yeah, it really is. And that's Nancy Oliver for you, I think. She can be very, very funny, but I think she also has a real talent for kind of digging her finger deeper into our psyches.
Speaking of both being accomplished in one line, like in that scene with Sookie and Jason, where he says something about how he's not too bright or whatever. And she goes, well, you could be if you use that brain, just didn't have it take up space between your skull, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't take them out of the touching moment. And she's like, you're not dumb. You're just lazy. And he almost sees, he's encouraged. He's like, really? You think? Oh, well, I'll try. I could try.
That's just the nicest thing anyone said to him in a while. Yeah. And then you, I think, pulled up another really interesting shifting dynamic within this episode.
Yeah, these power plays. We've got a lot. There's a lot of vampire interesting stuff that happened here because we have the blood bond that Eric manipulates and forces on Sookie. And I don't, I don't know that we knew or really isolated it because it's, previously, we've seen it with Bill and Sookie where it's part of this whole whirlwind romance. But between these two, it's mechanical and that she's tricked into it. And all of a sudden, we hear from Eric, she's part of me now. It's done. There's nothing you can do about it.
There's no reverse on
There's no reverse in this.
And it makes me think, too, about all the vampires that are selling V, like all of the people that bought V from Lafayette, can Eddie feel them all? Like, are they all having sexy dreams about an imaginary Eddie? Like, how does that, do you have to have seen or taken from the source? You know, like, that's such an interesting question I have now.
Totally. I really found myself going, wait a minute. Okay, wait a minute. What do we know? Wait, where are we at in the blood world here? And and who's Eric? Because he's manipulative, we think, but also he's playful, right? He's very funny. I think we see that side even more. We find out that he's very, very caring for one person, for Godric. But wait, is there more to this Sookie thing? So who is this Eric dude?
Right. Because you kind of go like, it does feel like there's some ulterior motive that might be more redeeming than we than we guess, right? Just knowing him, feeling him, what we see of how exactly, you know, how he responds to Godric, it's hard to believe that this is only a sinister move.
It is. It really is. And it does look from a certain angle like he might be getting a crush on a girl.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know.
I liked, you know, Bill has this line, though, that I think is really to the point.
Eric has had 1,000 years practice in deceit. He lied to prove his power to me. He counted on your goodness. There's no shame in that.
Yeah.
But he counted on her goodness, which is simultaneously more evil and oddly a compliment.
Yep. The plot thickens.
Yeah.
And then speaking of plot thickening, we have this wild scene Where, again, I'm like, whoa, wait, this took it up a notch with Nan Flanagan. Uh-huh. So she comes down off the TV screen.
She's real.
Now, we haven't seen her outside of the box previously.
Right.
And she can fire people? Wait a minute, hold on. And Godric, we know, is 2,000 years. We know Eric is 1,000 years. You must have looked
up. At least.
Right? Because you put in the notes here, Eric, Nan is 800 plus.
At least 800, yeah.
But she is top dog in that room.
Right, which seems crazy.
Right? We thought that she was only PR, which still she implies. She says, I'm on television, dude, so bring it on. But she's not at all threatened by anyone in that room. So there's an interesting hierarchy that we're witnessing for the first time.
Yes. She seems very secure. She seems like untouchable. So it seems like, you know, the American Vampire League, this AVL that we thought was maybe just, like you said, a PR, you know,
machine,
group,
yeah.
organization, yeah. maybe something more that is able to elevate her status beyond age, which has always been a very dominating hierarchy for vampires.
That's all we've had till now, the age. It's also fabulous, I'm realizing at this very moment. After, 14 years of living in the vampire world, I just had a realization. That's sad. But anyway, that it's reverse, right? Because in humans, aging is you become invisible and useless and, you know, put out to pasture. But in the vampire world, he's 800. He's 900. Like, it gets better and better, right?
Well, one place where it doesn't help you, though, which is really interesting, is meeting the sun.
Yeah.
Godric has this interesting line where he's like, at my age, it'll go really quickly. Whereas we saw Bill at 250 in pain, and there's smoke, and
crossing
he's
crossing the cemetery.
Oh my God, it's awful. But he can survive in the sun, like he healed and got back to it.
Yeah.
So I guess, it's like dry wood. Like older you are, the quicker you go up in flames.
And my mind is flashing forward quite a bit and can't quite remember, but this might be a thing we want to just put on a clipboard refer back to in a couple
just
of
track.
Seasons. Yeah, it was interesting, right? Because, he does just go poof. No pain.
It's very beautiful. Yeah,
it's beautiful. And maybe, we're going to have to put
nerdies.
That on a clipboard. I look forward to discussing this throughout the season.
I'm super, super curious. I think in my notes I wrote, like, Godric is dry wood and Bill is wet wood, which
right. Yeah, I need some frame of reference here. I'm totally confused now. But it is the most freaking touching scene.
Wow. I mean, it is definitely the highlight of the episode and one of the highlights of the season is this really lovely moment between Eric and Godric and then Sookie and Godric.
The way that they acted it and the way that Alex falls to his knees kills me. It kills me every time because Godric is half Alex's size, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting in the casting that, and how beautifully Alan played power, we've talked about, and wisdom. And to see Alex so big and tall over him fall to his knees,
and the tears, you know, streaming down his face. And, you know, I think Sookie and we as an audience needed to see that. Especially after this despicable, you know, trick her into drinking his blood moment that happened earlier.
Yeah.
We kind of needed to see that he is more than that.
We did. And it is interesting that they wrote her in witnessing that scene and the dialogue is stunning.
She's the only human. It's one of those things, you know, again, we think of vampires as being so much more powerful than humans. But in this case, she wins. She's the only one that can stay.
Do you believe in God?
Yes.
If you're right, how will he punish me?
God doesn't punish. God forgives.
I don't deserve it. But I hope for it.
We all do.
And then... again, Nancy Oliver slays me.
I know.
When that other clip that you pulled that will play for you, that is just the beauty and wisdom of that line and Anna being there and...
A human with me at the end. And human tears. 2,000 years. And I can still be surprised. In this I see God.
I'm getting a little choked up listening.
I know, I get choked up when I hear it even now.
Yeah.
And the music, you know, again, we don't notice this perfection of the soundtrack always.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's exactly to his point. You know, he's feeling guilty. He's feeling the years of harm that he's done. 2,000 years. Most of us only have to regret 80 or 90 if we're lucky. But he's got 2,000 years of drastic harm to atone for. And he's been trying in these last who knows how many decades or centuries, but he's worried just like a human would be about what happens to him after this.
Yeah. What happens in this, the next big mystery.
Yeah. And then it's this perfect, we're not so different, humans and vampires at the end together, feeling for one another. And it's, you know, we're different, but we're the same.
Right.
It's a really beautiful sentiment.
Really beautiful. Really beautiful. Ultimately, everyone's mortal eventually.
Well, we'll be speaking with Alan today, and he shared quite a bit more information about how difficult this was to shoot. And the reminder that he's really only in two, really three episodes this season. It's such a short-lived character, but it has such a huge impact.
Yeah. Well, and now for a quick bite, Q&A positive.
This week, we're answering a fan club question, and this one is brought to us by Madeline, or at Mads Mills.
So they ask, if Pam and Jessica are still alive, which I don't doubt they are, where do you think they would be now? Do you think they would have been affected by the pandemic? Much love, XXXX. So what do you have a thought on that, Deb?
I mean, I sort of do, because I always, thinking of like the sheltered life that Jessica had had, I thought she would travel, right? She can swim through the ocean if she wants to get there. But I feel like, you know, Bill probably left her some money, you know, that she would want to go see the world and learn some languages and, you know, meet other types of people. And I don't know if it would have happened this quickly, but I think she would have had her eyes set on politics. I think she would have wanted to become a sheriff and maybe queen someday.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. You could be queen.
Queen Hammy.
Totally. I've got a whole spinoff in my head of Pam.
You do?
Oh, Amazing. Dude. It's a whole freaking thing. The fabulous thing about playing Pam is that it's really free from all the stuff that burdens me, which is worry about the state of the world and speaking up for the voiceless and blah, 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 blah. And, you know, throughout the pandemic, I felt very vulnerable and isolated. And none of that would be in Pam's world. So, and I won't give spoilers, but Pam is totally doing fine and rich there at a certain point, we could imagine. Yep. So I've got her like part of this like crazy Bilderberger society where she's manipulating world politics and billionaires just for fun.
I have a feeling that like Jessica and Pam get together for like a virgin sangria. every couple of months and just, you know, chat about, because if you're working on manipulating human politics, Jessica's working on manipulating vampire politics. We can have kind of a power couple going there.
Totally. And she's still Auntie Pam. She's still mentoring you. She still has hopes for you.
And super, super sarcastic and, you know, hiding her affection. But I think there's a genuine friendship budding there.
Definitely. But the pandemic. Yeah.
The pandemic is an interesting question. And I had some thoughts. I thought, you know, social distancing would make it really hard to get a meal, for one. So that's a problem. But if you were immune, it actually means vampires could maybe do some good. You could keep the economy running, keep some businesses open.
Right.
You could run errands for vulnerable humans, I thought was sort of interesting idea. So, yeah, there could be kind of a strong vampire support system. Thank you, Madeline. That was a fascinating question. So this week's deep dive, we're going to talk about everything you ever wanted to know about background acting and possibly a bit more than you wanted to know.
I'm so glad that you brought this up, Deb, because this show, I guess a lot of shows, but not so much. Like our background actors are hugely important.
Hugely. And I really actually I wanted to address this now rather than even though this episode wasn't a huge background episode, but the next three coming up, what background performers are asked to do on True Blood is above and beyond.
Frostbite.
Yes, I wanted us to appreciate everything we're about to see with fresh eyes. You know, usually the job of a background performer is to blend in, right?
Right.
When two people are talking on a street, it wouldn't look right if the world wasn't alive around them.
Right.
But on True Blood, that wasn't always the case. You weren't always meant to blend in on True Blood.
Yeah. In fact, I'm just thinking of my years in Fantasia, right?
Yes.
I mean, what would Fantasia be without all those amazing extras?
Amazing people.
Right? Because you're expected to come dressed for the part.
Mm-hmm.
You know, costumes, probably on a period piece, you're going to get a lot more help.
Yes.
You know, of
you're not
course.
Expected to own a toga or something like that. Yeah.
You know, but, you know, you had to show up at Fantasia looking like you belonged at Fantasia. And we had regular people recurring, which can happen, which is nice
for
people.
Because in the background casting call, and if you're curious about this, you can go on the Central Casting website and you can see all of the different background jobs that are listed. And they get very specific.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, for something like Fantasia, they're going to say potentially vampire bar. It might even say True Blood if the show was out and you knew it. Maybe goth, you know, maybe, you know, piercings and tattoos, a plus kind of thing.
Yes,
you know?
Yes.
And we had some background that had some very interesting special skills that came with that. Pole dancing, funny double jointedness that they could do.
So yeah, we had a double jointed.
Interesting.
He could turn
dancing.
His feet around backwards.
Yeah. And it was one of those things. And people would keep coming back. So, you know, even though we didn't get to spend a lot of time really, you know, getting to know everybody very well.
Yeah.
There were people who were like, oh, yeah, I remember.
Hi. You know? Hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah.
It's all the same group, which was really fun.
And what's interesting about that, too, is the other thing background has to accomplish is that they know that the cast that's there to do a whole bunch of dialogue and do a whole scene. They're very respectful. So it's up to the actor to look to them to say, oh, hi. But they're not going to come over and tap you on the shoulder and say, hey, great scene, right?
Yeah.
There's a difficult sort of balance there that they accomplish.
Yes, it's very impressive. And it is a delicate line to walk. But my experience, especially with the background actors on True Blood, was that they were really adept at that, at giving space when you needed it. And the other thing is, you know, your job is to very specifically recreate what is sometimes a complex set of movements.
Right.
You have to be right on the cue.
Yes.
You have to lift that fork exactly at the same moment that you did it before, because you don't want to be the continuity error that, you know, messes with that take.
Right.
And so it takes really smart, patient, good listening skills.
Yes.
You know, I think really they are unsung heroes in this industry.
They are. If you think about it, you watch any scene where we've got these background actors, they did that walk across behind. Mm-hmm. They were dancing. They were drinking that True Blood for 12 hours behind every take, exactly the same.
And silently, right? It's pantomime most of the time. Which is incredible to make that look. Because, you know, again, we're talking about acting. It still has to be realistic and yes. committed and buy yeah. into what you're doing. So, I really am excited about this opportunity to sort of speak the praises of that career choice.
Yeah. And you and I both got our SAG cards by doing extra work because they give out a few SAG vouchers to limited number of extras on each day.
When you are a non-union background actor and you are working on a union job, they have oftentimes extra union voucher cards. And so one way that you can earn 3 vouchers, which you can then use to, get into the union, is to do be a non-union actor doing, union background work. And usually, they will offer them to people who are, again, on time, prepared, good listeners, good attitude. Now it's not, as we said, it's not a building platform for your career. This is not where you're going to, be discovered or make a connection, for your future career, but it can get you those vouchers. And more importantly, it can get you set experience.
Yes.
So having gotten my SAG card through background work, and I did have a special deal, so I only had to do a few days of it.
Yeah.
But I was so happy that my first day on a set wasn't one where I also had big scene work that I had to prepare.
Right.
That I knew what people's jobs were. I knew things like cross, back to one,
right.
These kinds of terms.
Yes.
That I had, interacted with a second AD who was the person who's going to choreograph and direct the background performers. So all of that is a really good way to just have a level of comfortability on a set.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Same thing. I did it on a few big movies, actually. And fascinating.
Yeah.
Totally fascinating. And long days. You got to bring your own chair. You should bring your own food because the craft service isn't as good. But really a valuable experience for me.
It is. And every once in a while, there are perks. There are bumps that you get depending on your hours, depending on what you are brought, what you bring with you. If they use your car in a shot, you get a bump. If you get a line, they'll get you a bump. Sometimes
you take off your clothes and act like you're having sex in an orgy, you'll probably get a bump. And then if you wear black contacts at the same time where you can't see anything, you probably get a bump.
So True Blood was, and this is also a multiple episode gig for these orgy goers. They want
It's not just one orgy. No.
It's not. Yeah. It's the same general group of people because this is a small town. So you're looking at a good little run of a show here for a group of people and some pretty crazy fun stuff. Coming up, the mob is really amazing.
It's incredible. It's incredible. And they were incredible.
They're so good. Really, really good. And it takes, again, there's a nuance to it. You can't go too far, nor can you be too subtle. So again, so impressed with the work we're going to see.
Yeah.
This show, True Blood, very, very specific background work, probably a lot of bumps going on, and just a grand old party, I hope.
Well, literally, the next 3 episodes. Yes. When you said probably a few bumps going on, my tired mind went to there's a lot of bumps. The next 3 episodes. Oh, that's humps. Right. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. But also keeping in mind, something like nudity or contact lenses are likely to be listed in the casting call. So this is never something that is
You're going to show up in your 1950s perfect classic dress and they're going to be like, okay, take it off. What? No, wait, no. What? No, you're going to know. You're going to know. And I think
you will have submitted yourself and you will have seen it in the submission. Yeah. So you can choose not to submit.
Yeah, that's, don't worry. You're not going to end up in a True Blood.
Without knowing.
We don't want to scare people. And now you are going to get to hear our interview with Alan Hyde, who plays Godric. What a mesmerizing performance. A high school student who flew to the United States to take on the role. Such a detailed and deeply empathic old soul performance.
Hi, Alan.
What up?
Hello.
It's so wonderful to see you.
Oh, my God, Trick.
Here we go.
Oh my God.
That's all good. Good to see you.
And thank you so much for coming to talk to us.
Of course. I've been looking forward to this.
Oh, good. Us too. It's been such a pleasure watching your work in season two and beyond. I think Kristen and I have both skipped around a little bit to see the other scenes.
Exactly. It's so wild. Like, I have a friend who is so wonderful, and she works for the Humane Society, saving everything. And she always says to me, "Oh my God, Rick!" Like, when anything exciting happens, like, "Oh my God, Rick, we saved 1,000 seals."
That's great. So
that lives in my world. Plus, you're my grandfather.
Yes, I realized that. I'd completely forgotten everything about that. When you emailed me first, said, "Hey, granddad," I was like, what is going on? And then I had to kind of do the math, and they're like, "Yeah, okay, right. That makes sense." But it has been it's been many years, and so it's kind of, I had to kind of bring it all back.
Totally. And Alex and I still communicate. You know, I call him daddy, calls me his daughter.
Makes sense. Makes completely sense.
I don't quite do that with Steve, I have to say. But it's wonderful to see you. And we're so excited to talk about the character of Godric, your work, what your experience was making the show. Usually we like to jump in and ask about your casting, your audition, and see if you have sort of a story about how that went down.
Well, I do. And this is probably the story that I've told most times, because it was, in my life, it was a very, very big thing. It was what completely turned my life around. I'm from Denmark. I lived in Copenhagen. I was 19 years old. I was in high school. I was two months away of graduating. And then I got this random call from a Danish agent. I didn't have an agent at the time, because Denmark, the business is so small. You didn't really need agents back then. But he'd seen a film I'd done. And apparently he had gotten word that they were looking for this guy on True Blood, and he was like, "Would you want a self-tape?" And self-tape was not a thing back then.
No.
And I'd never done it before. I'd never auditioned for anything outside of Denmark. And then,
oh my gosh,
I was like, "Sure, we can try that." And I showed up in his office, and we did this take, and we sent it off. And he said, "We do these every once in a while with our clients, and you know, it was great meeting you, but we'll probably won't hear anything back." That's at least how I remember it. And then I go back to school, and 2 days later, I was really good. I finished like a physics test before, and I got to leave the room, and I checked my phone, and they were like, call us immediately. And I called them back, and they were like, "Apparently Alan Ball watched your audition, and they want you for the part straight off from the self-tape. And you have, we need to get a visa in order." And I was like, "What does this mean?" "Well, you need to leave in a minute, a couple of weeks." Oh. Because I don't know why they hadn't cast the part. Maybe someone, I've never been told why someone lost it. They couldn't find the guy, but at least it felt down to the wire. Yeah. And I had to decide, I had to drop out of high school. And I flew to LA, and my first thing was, I think I might have gone to the lot. I did go to the lot and met Alan and probably a fitting or something. But then the first day of work was the Viking flashback. And then I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I remember. I was on the plane. I'd done these mock-up sides that weren't really from the show. So I didn't really know what part I'd gotten. So I was on the plane. I dropped out of school, and then I was reading the scripts, and I was like, this is good. And then I was like, oh, this is really good. But fast forward to, I ended up staying for 4 years. So I went straight from living with my parents, going to high school, to living by myself in LA. And
in a foreign country. Yeah.
Yeah. It was wild. And I think looking back at it, had I known what part I got, what the show was, how big it was, I would have probably not been able to do it. Like, I would have been, I would have been scared shitless. Wow. I mean, now, if every time, like, just auditioning for something great or whatever, I get nervous these days, because now I know what it means and how high the stakes are. But I didn't really know back then.
Oh, the innocence of youth.
Yes.
It's amazing that you uprooted your life so much for something you knew so little about. That takes a big leap of faith.
And in that first scene that you have where you turn Alex/Eric, is he speaking Swedish and you're speaking Danish?
Swedish.
No, we're both speaking Swedish. Yeah.
So how did you manage that? Because, I mean, it's much closer, I assume, for you than for me. But when I had to speak Swedish, it was just, you know, so nerve-wracking.
We did this exact same thing that I imagine you did. Alex would record the lines and I would just mimic them.
Yes. Yes. And how close are the languages?
Very, did you, very close. But the music, the melody of the, it's just, it's different. Many, my parents' generation, they can speak Swedish because they grew up watching Swedish TV. I didn't. So in my generation and generations after didn't. So we're not great at faking our Swedish. So Alexander helped with that stuff and it worked, but still I do get people in Scandinavia who has seen it. I think Danes wouldn't hear it. Yeah. Swedes, they can definitely hear that I'm not from Sweden.
Well, as an American listener, you sound perfect. And it is a chilling scene. I mean, the two of you are
connected. It's so beautiful.
Yeah.
It's hard to believe that's the day you met.
Oh, we met before because Alexander was really nice when I...
Oh, that's right. You said he helped you.
Yeah, he helped me. And when I flew over, he was really nice. And obviously, he knew that I was completely just 19 years old and just very, very confused and excited. We hung out a little bit. And so I knew him. But I think just the adrenaline of being on set for me personally was just, you know, how that's just... create sparks on camera. You can't really fake that stuff. You can try to get to that point, but that was just so, I didn't really need to act that much because I obviously I needed to be in the scene, but I think everything all was just working for it. So I, again, I don't think had I really been on top of the situation, I think I would have not done a particularly great job in the scene. Had I really, really known what I was doing.
I agree with you. There's something to when you're nervous and it's your first time and you don't really know what you're doing, that adds such a presence and energy to the scene that does kind of go away as you get more comfortable. And it's, you do feel like, how do I find ways to put myself back in that space where my natural human.
Yeah, it becomes another day at the office, which is weird. And then every once in a while, that I find that the stuff that's great is these days is when the best stuff is when I or someone other than myself, if there's a little mistake and someone is just like just pushed a little bit off balance, the scrambling to get back on your feet, just if it's just a line or a word you miss or whatever, it's that's when. You see this, the adrenaline and stuff, the real humanity kick in.
Yeah.
And I guess everything in that scene from my perspective was just survival.
Well, I just thought of a couple of things. And one is, it's so interesting that your relationship on camera with Godric and Eric is the opposite of you two as real people, because you were like, oh my gosh, I just got out of high school. I do not know what I'm doing. Please help me. And I have to speak your language. Ugh. And then on camera, your dialogue, the stuff that they wrote for you, I almost transcribed every scene for this interview because it's really, really beautiful.
It is, yeah.
And it's so evolved, right?
Exactly,
and so poignant and so touching and sad and wise.
I just rewatched some of the scenes because I was like, wow, this is deep. This is very enlightened. And I'm not sure that I was aware how deep it was when we did it. But now I see just how it worked out at the end and also how it relates to the rest of the story. And because sometimes you just do one scene, you're right there, but you're actually tapping into something that's much larger than that, just that one scene, this whole season and just the whole backstory of thousands of years of whatever they've been doing. I was very fortunate to be working with not just on the show, but with that character and those words specifically.
Yeah. Right. The writing is really beautiful. And And I, you know, you now that's what you're doing is writing. So really for the actor, we can't really, I think we can't hold the whole big picture in our head, and we wouldn't as people in that situation. So I go, okay, I'm actually purposefully going to not know the whole scope of the thing because I wouldn't, Pam wouldn't.
No.
You know, I try to find wherever I can find some reality, but it is so much of your dialogue. I mean, I literally have it transcribed here, but I love, what does he say when Newland says, kill me, Jesus will protect me. He says, I'm actually older than your Jesus. I wish I could have known him, but I missed it.
Yeah,
it is.
That's a funny
love
line.
That, like,
yeah.
But I missed it. How was it shooting those huge scenes as well? Because as a new actor, you know, they had a pretty good budget on this show. And those were really big scenes there at the Fellowship.
Oh my God. I've done a couple of big budget Danish and one Norwegian really big budget film, but you know, it still doesn't compare to True Blood and the set pieces we had there. Like the first scene, the flashback, I got to rip someone's throat. And it was all the special effects and for the Fellowship scenes, this huge church and standing on that balcony and this huge crane with a camera and a wire in my back so I didn't fall over and kill myself. And it was just so massive, everything. And we shot everything on 35 mil.
We were still on film back then.
Yeah, people don't realize that's a big deal, right? Like shooting on film, it's expensive. It's huge, and that they chose to spend that money for that quality was pretty enormous.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, and for the Fellowship scenes and all, and especially the last scene that I was in, we shot real time. We had four of those cameras running film at the same time.
Was that your death scene?
Yeah.
To capture the actual sunrise. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I remember we... I mean, I don't remember if it was a full day, but we did a day of rehearsals somewhere else. No, actually, we went to set a day before and rehearsed. And then we got back the next morning and we knew we had, I think, 40 minutes, you know, which is pretty like, you know, the magic hour kind of. We had 40 minutes to shoot this whole scene that is, I forget, but it must be like five, six pages of dialogue. It was long. And in order for them to capture that, they did four cameras with super, like, because also super long, the film cartridges, whatever, so they could shoot long takes. And then they would do two takes in one position. Mm-hmm. And then they would just, like, move them back to second positions and shoot the whole thing, I think, twice. Mm. And then we did get to do one day, which was weird. So obviously all my close-ups... And the facing my direction was done, I think, a week later on a soundstage on a green screen, which was super nerve wracking because doing that scene on the rooftop, we had to all be like, you couldn't just stand around just half feeding your lines when you were over shoulder. You had to be there. It was super intense. And then I had to recreate that. Mm-hmm. For my stuff a week later with, you know, a super artificial setup. Mm. But I was just like, I remember that setup on the rooftop was mind-blowing. Mm.
Both of those are really hard to do because there's so much pressure. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you specifically about that because I thought, did they had to shoot that in real time in like 30 minutes? Mm-hmm. And the pressure on actors, on one hand, it's like the Olympics, right? Mm-hmm. You're all in it together. And that's pretty incredible. And it's such an emotional scene. I cry every time. Mm-hmm. And then the opposite difficulty where it's just you standing in front of a green piece of fabric in some stage with, you know, Alex and Anna off camera in their robes.
In their UGG boots,
In their UGG boots, right?
I do remember. I think they were pretty generous and they were
They were
stepping up to the plate. But it's still not, still not the same.
Yes.
You know, it's still not the same.
Right.
Yeah. But on the other hand, it's good and bad because then we got to take my takes more times and there was no stress.
Yeah.
So I guess the pressure was a little bit off, which was also good. Mm. So we got to actually like take a minute. I could actually get some real direction, mm-hmm. which I remember yeah. I believe it was Scott Winant who directed. And I remember him mostly saying, we like the slow pace, but please pick it up a little bit because I would just really beat it out. Just like take my time. I think with Godric specifically, I was a lot like when you're that old, like old people, elderly people, they take their time.
Yeah.
And they're, right. It's just like super low pace, super low. And I was like, if you've been around for thousands and thousands of years, you can, you take your time and you're not stressed about anything. And so it was deliberate that I would really, really like drag it out. But I guess in some takes it was a little bit too much.
Well, but talk to us more about some of those kinds of choices and in taking on the role of Godric and playing someone so old and also having to do this evolution from being 1,000 years old to 2,000 years old. And, you know, what are your thoughts and how you prepared for that?
Well, as far as I remember, I spend a lot of time trying to internalize what it would be in my life. Because these emotions were so huge that I couldn't relate to having tortured and killed and raped and stuff for thousands and thousands of years and feeling the regret that Godric did at the end. But I know what regret feels like, and I know what having done stuff that I'm not proud of feels like. And I would try to tap into some of those feelings in my own life and actually like write them out like a little diary to myself and kind of use them as something to build on. And then again, as I said, with just the pacing and the beating out, and he always took his time and he was very underplayed. In many ways, was very like stone-faced, but that was very, very deliberate. Yes. That was like, just be there and let the scene play its way. So some of those choices were basically just to do with wisdom, experience, and status, I guess. Also the status in the room. If you take your time, you know, power, silence, keeping people waiting, and they're like, it gets people a little bit uncomfortable and stuff. Yeah. It just takes the beat out. But I think the short answer
was power.
Exactly. But just trying to take the different scenes and the overall feeling and trying to relate it to my own life.
I think, you know, Kristen has shared a lot of her stories about working with Alex, and I think that was a very unique relationship.
Yeah.
And I'm curious if you have stories, memories of working with him, and that's sort of the intimacy required of that relationship.
I really enjoyed working with him, but I think it was interesting also, like you said, Kristen, it was very much the opposite dynamic because I was just super... not starstruck, but a little bit intimidated by his presence and by his...
Oh, we all were.
deep inside, I wanted to be his friend. It's so hard. And he was so nice to me.
Yeah.
He's so cool. But I knew that we really like, especially like on the page, like your relationship, Kristen, with him, like father, son, father, daughter.
Right.
Like it was also like I felt like we really needed to have this extraordinary relationship. And I couldn't really tell if we had it or not. But I really enjoyed working with him, and he helped me out a lot, and he made me feel at home when I first arrived in LA. Mm-hmm. And he took me to hang out with his friends and made me feel like I wasn't a complete stranger in a very strange city.
Yeah, because he had to put up with me for 7 years, so many days, he eventually convinced me that he is that nice, but he also actually likes me.
Oh, that's good. That's
great. He might just be the greatest actor in the world to keep that up for 7 years. Your relationship with, you know, the Godric-Eric relationship was so profound. One of the writers, I believe it was Bucky, told me that they inspired them to develop the relationship between Eric and Pam because they went, oh, wait a minute. If he has that, Eric has that incredible love for Godric, she would have that for Eric.
Mm-hmm.
So it really informed so much of the show. I mean, it really informed my trajectory a lot from what they told me.
That's cool. It also, that's always how it is. You never really know what it is before you see it on its feet. And,
right.
And Godric wasn't supposed to be in the next couple of seasons, but he became like a fan favorite or a character that people would be asking for. And so they decided to bring me back for a brief moment here and there.
Yes. So when you think of your experience, the whole experience from like the audition all the way through your 4 years, what have you, anything related to True Blood, are there three words that come to mind about it?
Oh my God.
Descriptive words.
Oh my God.
I know you have to think of them in English as well.
Apologize.
You can say them in Danish possibly.
Have you listened to how many words I use to describe a super simple question? This is the toughest thing for me is to say something brief, short, and precise. Brief, short, precise might be the
me
three
too.
Words I have to go with. It was brief, short, and precise, actually.
It was. That's funny.
It's such a cliche.
It's fine.
That's again, if I cliches start editing myself, I want to say life-changing experience.
Yeah.
Because my experience on the show was much more than just being on the show. It was my transition from being a big child into being a grown up on like living by myself, having to stand on my own feet. And that happened during shooting True Blood.
Yeah. Life-changing experience from your story. That does encapsulate. And that's huge. Life-changing.
Well, thank you, Alan. It's just...
Yeah, the mind is a tricky piece.
It's been incredible to dive into your mind.
Yes, and I wish I could just hear your stories, but I you've probably touched upon those a bunch of times through this whole podcast series.
Yeah, the podcast is our stories, basically.
So yes, yes.
You get to be the special guest. Oh, Kristen, I can't even. He's so adorable. And I mean, I know he's a grown man and I can't call a grown man adorable, but
no,
there's just an energy about him that is so endearing and welcoming.
Authentic.
Yes. Very authentic.
Right?
And I'm so pleased for him and the success that he's having in Denmark.
Yes.
I did not know him very well, you know, back in the day. So this was a sort of
I
a first really,
really
get to know you conversation. And I think what's really telling is the impact of his character.
Yeah.
From really such a small stint.
Yes.
On the show.
I agree. Huge
or a short
impact.
Stint, I should say.
Yeah. I have such strong, I mean, I really, I was fighting back tears almost the whole interview because I have such a strong feeling. Now I can cry because it would have been really embarrassing. There was no moment where it would have made sense, right? But I have such a strong feeling about him and I don't even totally understand it. I'm like, is he conduit to Eric, Alex? Is he... His character is so beautiful. His death scene, I don't know what's happening to me. The Denmark.
Well, he and Alex have that same thing. I've always described this when people ask me what Alex is like. And I think he has it too, which is when they look at you, you feel like they are seeing past your face into your soul or something like that.
It's like they're
mystical.
Really there looking at you. They're just there taking you in.
Yeah, they're not thinking about something else or their grocery list
or
some other person or themselves. They're really looking at you. And he, even across the internet lines of existence, the ethernet, I still feel that looking at him in a little box on my screen.
I know. I have so much stronger feelings for him than his... natural
that is appropriate
that is appropriate. I'm glad I sort of hid them
for
through
how
the whole
well we
thing
know
oh my God.
Well, just a huge thanks for him for taking the time and sharing with us, and
what a lovely person.
I hope you all enjoyed it.
Mm.
Next week on Truest Blood, we sit down with Jim Herrick, the extraordinary actor behind Hoyt Fortenberry and one of my absolute favorite scene partners. He's gone on to other incredibly illustrious roles in films like Fury and Suicide Squad and As I Lay Dying.
Yeah.
He also did a run on Broadway in Of Mice and Men and has since found a home as Judd Ryder on 911 Moonstar.
He is so spectacular. I'm enjoying his performances so much. And finally, everyone returns home to Bon Tom, but it is not the place they left. We will talk about mob mentality, Bacchanalia. Mm-hmm. We're going to tell you what that means, and you know it because you've been watching it. And homegrown heroes, all brought to life by an award-worthy array of character actors.
Oh, it is an embarrassment of talent, and you won't want to miss it.
Yep.
So thanks for listening, Troopies. Subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll see you next week.
Y'all come back now, you hear?
Got any burning questions you want answered on Truest Blood? Post them on any and all social media platforms using hashtag FangClubQuestions, and we may feature them on the show. That's hashtag FangClubQuestions. Truest Blood is produced by Safe Haven for HBO Max. Executive producers are Janina Kavankar, Kristen Bauer, and Deborah Ann Wool. Our producer is Gabrielle Galan, and our audio producer is Christopher Wool. Our theme song was recorded just for this podcast by Jace Everett. Additional music was composed by Timo Chen. And remember, you can watch all of the original episodes of True Blood on HBO Max.